I love sport
because of its purity, of its simplicity.
But it gives you a sense of identity, whether you as an individual or as a nation.
And that's why we love sport.
You're listening to Falling in Sport with me, Mzama Moloi. We're still falling in love, one sport at a time, even in the midst of a pandemic. On this episode, I take you on a trip down memory lane with the football that raised me and millions more. I talk to former Bafana Bafana coach Clive Barker about winning titles, his regrets, and that game against Brazil. We also hear from legendary commentator Mark Gleeson about why football has changed for the better. These conversations were recorded before the 2020-2021 season began. Okay, let's fall in sport. Depending how well or badly your favorite team is doing, football can be the ultimate exercise in hope. I grew up on a steady diet of Soweto derbies, football in the street, and a love for South Africa's national team, Bafana Bafana. At our best, we were amazing to watch. That Bafana Bafana was so popular, they even had calendars. Do you know how iconic you had to be in the 90s to get calendars made in your honor? If I remember correctly, at our house, we had the black Sasol edition. Yes. I still remember Andre Arens' action shot at full stretch, diving to make a save. Despite spending just 3 years in charge, the architect of that team's success was Clive Barker. Because of his role as coach of that 90s golden generation, Coach Barker is at the center of many childhood memories when it comes to soccer. I recently watched highlights of the opening game between Bafana Bafana and Cameroon at the AFCON 96, and it immediately took me back to my parents' couch on that Saturday afternoon, seeing those first two goals and then the late Shoes Moshoe's goal to make a 3-0. What was it like coaching that team? Was it more about man management, or was it more tactics? What was it like?
Well, I think that was always man management. I think that, I thought that was the only way to game football. I always thought that the only reason we could make an impact in the world stage was if I got my team to play to their ability, we'd have an outside chance to qualify. And so I concentrated more on the South African team and worrying about whether somebody was playing. And so I thought it was just the way to go, and first of all, just to worry about the first team and nothing else.
That team goes on to win AFCON 1996. So you won those first two games, and then you lost. I remember watching that loss to Egypt. And you go on, you go into the quarters, you go into the semis, you beat Ghana. Going into that final game, that final match against Tunisia, what were your motivating words for the players?
Well, you know, when you go along and you're qualifying and you're doing this and you're doing that and you're winning, I think you just think that you're on the right path, but you can always hit the wall and come tumbling down. And but the African climb was a marvellous way for us to show our skills. And we had the flair of Doctor and Shoes, and that was incomparable. Two central midfield players, it was Neil Tovey, McCarthy, and our setup. And I think he was one of two players that would have made the cutoff. I would have thought that we had a team that could win the World Cup. I think it's been proved over the years, qualifying to play in the top 10 sides in the world, home and away. Losing only 2 out of 29 games in Africa and qualifying. So I just think that they had everything going for them, and I just had to guard it the right way and sensibly, and I think we were able to do that, and it's up to get it right this time again.
In that qualifying run to qualify for the World Cup in 98, remember that pretty much that boxing match in the Congo. What did you say to the guys after that game? I mean, like, I remember Mark Fish looking like a boxer on that occasion.
I think I lost an opportunity. We saw the game out like that, but as you know, the TV were ushered out of the stadium. Everybody that was South African wasn't allowed in. We weren't allowed to change in the change rooms. It was really, really tough. And I thought to myself, there's no way that Germany would have off the bus and go onto the football stadium if they had to qualify. But we got on with it and we did the best of a bad situation, and we got beaten that day. And in the quality of football, I think that they were better than us on the day. But it was really, really tough to have to go through all that. And of course, with the fact is that they pulled rifles and cocked them and got ready to shoot us if we really wanted to do anything, right or wrong. But it all ended up in the right way in the end. So no mistake of the fact that they were better on that day. But they certainly had a lot of intimidation.
History lesson for the uninitiated. Congo Brazzaville was in South Africa's group in World Cup qualifying. Sure, the Red Devils won their home match against Bafana Bafana by 2-0. But if we're being honest, the Congolese used every trick from the how to intimidate your opponents without killing them handbook. A pitch invasion by AK-47 carrying soldiers, fans storming the opposing dressing room, the works. With both teams on 10 points going into the last round of matches, the return leg in Johannesburg 4 months later was winner takes all.
I'm reminded of then we come home and that goal, that Philemon Masinga goal to take us to the World Cup. You're looking from the sidelines and you see that go in, and you immediately, when that ball flies into the net, you almost as if you were flying with it. Can you take us through that moment when that goal goes in?
And the genius that he was, Doctor, of course, he intercepted the pass.
Yes.
And picked it up, and he was just outside, about 20, 30 metres outside their goal. And he just caressed the pass through to Philemon, and Philemon got onto it, and the ball came over the shoulder, and he hit it in a squeeze, and it screamed into the back of the net. And, of course, that was the game and goal that took us to the World Cup. It was fabulous because he's no longer with us today, but I'm quite sure he looks down at everything that's football and that's good. He was wonderful all around. He was never the favourite of the supporters because he was a little bit ungainly, and he had his way of scoring goals, and
yeah. We
could always rely on him in the big matches to get us one or two. I'll never forget that because, as you say, it settled nasty for them, but gosh, he put it home the right way and then took off. And I think I decided to run because the Gala had done that for me in Brazil.
Yeah.
Played us one evening. And I went, you will ask me the question, I'm sure, to say to me, why did you take Doctor off?
Sure.
And we'll go through that a bit longer. I need a bit of time.
Yeah. just to hark back onto AFCON 96. AFCON happens. We win AFCON in the aftermath of having where we readmitted back into world sports. We go to the Olympics for the first time in 92. We have our elections in 94. We win the Rugby World Cup in 1995. And then we win AFCON in 96. Did you think in your mind that this was a opportunity? Did you see it as an opportunity to unite the nation further? Was it for you, this is a coming out party for us? What were your... Did you have any thoughts outside of just playing the game? Did you have any thoughts about what it would do for the fabric of the nation?
Yeah, I think I was at the World Cup when we won at rugby, and Joel Stransky docked the ball through. Fantastic to give us the victory. But Andy hit it. I sat right behind it and now I feel myself, this is a lot more pressure now, because everybody knows that there's most supported sport in South Africa is football.
Mm.
Rugby has just done us very proud recently, but to have the responsibility of Nelson Mandela on one side and having to win on the other side, and as he hit the ball and went through the post, I saw myself, gosh, there's going to be extra pressure. And you know, he was such a fantastic person, Nelson. He was phoned home on Friday, and my niece Susie had answered the phone, and she would come to me and she would say, there's a guy by the name of Nelson wants to talk to you. And of course, he was always there for us and prior to the match. And he would put us under all types of pressure. But he knew too exactly that it was the black supported sport that needed to come and take some of the responsibility and they did. And, it was a fantastic setup in South Africa, and I was only so pleased to be part and parcel of it.
My most memorable football memory would have to be the 1996 AFCON final. I was 9 years old and I went to the final with my parents. I don't think I've ever experienced anything like it since. The vibe in the stadium that day is something that stuck with me, and it's definitely, I would mark that day out as the day that I became a true football fan.
Memory isn't even close. There's only one contender for this, and that's the goal that Simpiwe Tshabalala scored in the opening match of the 2010 World Cup. The only close second to that is the atmosphere inside the stadium in Bloemfontein when South Africa were beating France in our final group game and we had the potential to qualify. That atmosphere was the most electric I've ever felt inside a sports stadium.
It didn't happen in a world-class football stadium. It happened on the dusty fields of Ha-Mampane. My mother, a soccer coach, brought her under-13 boys team to watch a game at home. On match day, the kids mimicked what they saw Emerson do on TV. They won the game and won soccer kits for the club.
Now let's talk about that Brazil game. Obviously, the context was that Brazil had sent a largely under-23 squad in preparation for the Olympics at Atlanta 96. But it's not like they sent over farmers. They had Dida in goal, World Cup winner Aldair in defense, Flavio Conceição and Rivaldo in midfield, and not forgetting baby cradling, bicycle kicking Bebeto up front. Going into that game, how much of a, what was the thought process in, we win this game, we stamp our ground as saying we're not just fly-by-nighters. I mean, I remember you'd see comments about some people saying Nigeria weren't at the AFCON, so South Africa aren't the real champions. And I think to myself, you play whoever's in front of you. Whoever's not there, that's their problem. So what were your thoughts going into that Brazil game? I just remember watching that game, just being glued to the screen. That Bebeto goal obviously was a downer, but to see South Africa compete.
Yeah, I thought we got so much out of that game because nobody gave us a chance. And that night we saw the magnificent skill and flair of Dr. Kamala. Mm. He was absolutely brilliant, and he dictated the whole game against the side that was arguably the best in the world, and he made them look very ordinary. And only he could have done something like that. Hughes was very, very close to him. But if he had to pick a choice, and I didn't want to make publicly a choice, I would always go doctor, because a doctor created more chances in front of goal than any other player that we had, and he would set things up, and he had the ability. And that night, what happened is, unfortunately, I made a terrible decision. I apologize to South Africa many, many times when I took Dr. Rook and they were 2-0 up. He's got his version of what he feels would be on the half-time setup. But unfortunately, it didn't work out well for us, and we went from 2-0 up to 3-2 down, but having taken Brazil so far as on that ride,
yeah,
it was an absolutely magnificent performance.
And you did.
I got a lot of enjoyment out of it.
No,
I've only watched it over the last couple of months. I never watched one of our games.
Wow.
And I never got that serious about football. But I was a fanatic in wanting to win and wanting to know the way to win. I was delighted that, but I messed it up that after that evening because we had them against the wall and I should have stuck it away and I didn't. But my car was teaching me a league race this year.
My favorite player has to be Manuel Neuer. I remember I used to think his synonym was never. But the way he played, the way he changed the modern goalkeeping, he became a super player. He was an option for his teammates, and that allowed Bayern Munich to be able to play higher up because they knew they had someone who would clear the lines from a long ball. So the way he played, he changed the modern goal player.
Zidane is a star, but I think my favorite player, I'd have to give it to Xavi. Also, I think because of the time frame I was in and I was starting to coach, and he was interviewed and he said that every 3 seconds he keeps his head around, he keeps on looking for opportunities on where to pass and what to do, even when he doesn't have the ball, that by the time he gets the ball, he knows what to do with the ball. So for me, I'll give it to Xavi.
For me, it's all about people who have just brought joy to the football field. Guys like Benny McCarthy, Gift Leremi, OG Mabizela, Lucas Radebe, Ronaldinho, Xabi Alonso, Leo Messi, Cristiano Ronaldo, regardless of whichever team you support, there are people who just show kind of the kind of skill that you can just stay in admiration.
I'm just reminded of where you were talking about Doctor. I know it's hard because it's almost like choosing your favorite child as per se, but who was your most favorite player to coach during that era?
There were different players at different shows. I mean, Lucas Radebe recovered to play a big part in us winning the AFCON. I just think that there were different times for different players, but I think consistently, I just looked at Doctor that night against Germany. I left him to last in the team talk, and I said to him, Doctor, since you're only your wife, your mother, and your granny, thinks that we can win this game and things like that. I said, but when you get out here tonight, on the first time you get the ball, no matter where you are, do something to get that crowd on our side. And as the ball came to him, he slowed it down and he pushed the ball right through Muller's legs. we were on the way. And I remember Bertie Fox saying to me when he walked across the field, he said, that's the most you've ever seen a German side turn inside out. And even Zane, he said, right at the end, had a great chance to make it a win for us, but just didn't quite get it. It was a good shot at goal, and the goalkeeper turned it around for a corner.
On reflection, Dr. Khumalo played a hand in all three goals that changed South Africa's football history. He took the free kick that led to Mark Williams' opener in the AFCON final. And it was his tackle and pass that set up the nation builder for his second. Again, 16V's ability to turn defense into attack in a split moment saw him intercept a loose Congo pass before feeding Phil Masinga for that goal to send Bafana to the World Cup. Looking back now, I think Doctor wasn't just a skillful player. In his prime, he was truly the complete package.
That's, when I look at different times, different players, they all came to the party. And I think the game that sticks in my memory for the rest of my life will be the night against Ghana. So I thought that Nigeria weren't there because of various reasons. Nobody would have beaten that night. In fact, we would have won against any team in the world.
Absolutely.
Which I say really well. But unfortunately, it didn't turn out like that against Brazil. So for the last time, I'm going to say to the people, I was delighted about everything, but I made the wrong decision with Doctor. So everybody, I'm sorry.
You are forgiven. Many times over, you are forgiven. One of the seminal moments of my sporting memory is the day I heard Clive Barker had resigned as Bafana Bafana coach in 1997. As African champions and World Cup bound, South Africa competed in their first FIFA Confederations Cup in late 97. A 1-0 loss to the UAE, a thrilling 2-2 draw against the Czech Republic, and a nail-biting 4-3 loss to Uruguay saw Bafana crash out of the tournament in the group stage. As soon as South Africa's exit was confirmed, calls to drop Barker as head coach grew. SAFA didn't back their man, and he left instead before they could fire him. I remember former SABC Sports host Brian Mulder broke the news to the nation. They played a montage of Barker's achievements and his energetic sideline manner. And the soundtrack they used was a song I've never gotten out of my head since. Search for Walk Away by Cast on YouTube. That's the song they used. Walk Away. What was it like saying goodbye to that team? Because you'd taken us to the World Cup. It felt in that moment, it felt like, I remember as a young person feeling like, this is not right. Despite you leaving, despite you resigning, it just felt like it felt like we're being robbed. Can you take us into the decision making, into you walking away from the job?
Yeah, it was on the plane coming back from, I think it was England. And I think the players were all sitting up and talking to each other, and they were in the aisle seats of the airplane. And I just thought to myself, you know, do I need this anymore now? Because I think I've done enough of it like that. And I wanted to, I didn't want the extra pressure to be building all the time, because what we had done at SAFA was to get the 10 top world sides. And we just about got them, Germany and the likes of Argentina and all the good sides. And we were very close to beating them or drawing with them. And I was very, very happy the way it had gone. And then all of a sudden it came home to me that maybe the people have got it right. That's why I've been there too long. And I think also the hierarchy didn't like the fact that it was like Barker's babes instead of Manchester United's babes, no country babes. So I just thought of at that stage maybe it would be the right move to move on. So I called the players and I said, let me get back to South Africa. I've got some maybe good news, bad news and different news. But I'm no longer going to be the coach in charge of Bafana. I think in retrospect now, there was a coward's way out. I should have stuck in a bit longer and walked away from it for a couple of weeks. But it was getting close to the World Cup and the preparation had to be good. And of course, I went for, I think, Jama at first, and then first Kofi, and I think Kofi, unfortunately, didn't quite deliver. And I think that one thing I do regret is that I let the players down in the choice of resigning. I should have carried on a little bit longer, and I would have got it right. And I don't say we would have won the World Cup, but I do know that we would have had a much happier face. Representing South Africa and the coaching side of it. Anyway, that's all history now, and it's like the new hierarchy can turn this thing around again. But it was marvelous all around, except when I let the players down. I should never even apologize for that.
Sure. Well, thank you for that perspective, Coach. I really appreciate that. I think that brings a lot of closure, and for me, in terms of that decision and what happened there. And I think you saying what you're saying now brings a lot of closure for me in that respect of, okay.
Good.
And I think a lot of people would have wanted to hear that. And I really appreciate that.
Football has taught me that talent alone is not enough. You have to work hard. You need to have the right attitude. You need to develop certain principles, especially teamwork, as understanding that the name at the back doesn't really matter than the name on the left side of your chest, which is the badge of the team that you play for.
The game has taught me to always focus on my strength, to be able to plan for the future, to take bits and pieces from everything around me. As a team, you learn from other teams so that the wheel of cycle becomes easier as you remodel it to fit your strengths.
I think what I've learned from football is that there's no language barrier in football. There's no cultural barrier in football. There's only football. And in any corner of the world, the language of football can be spoken and understood and enjoyed and appreciated, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Football has taught me that it has the power to change entertainment into identity. It can give a person a place of belonging.
I think it has taught me that even the underdog can go on to do really well. And I know that's the thing we always talk about with regard to football, about how anything can happen and you can never really make predictions when it comes to football. And life is pretty much that same way too. Football tells stories of hope and inspiration every day. We saw Leicester win the English Premier League not so long ago, and who would have ever imagined that?
You've managed, you've coached several clubs, and a recurring theme is AmaZulu. I think of you leave Bafana and you go and you coach some other teams, but it occurred to me the other day, did you ever get any approaches from Chiefs or Pirates? Because you were the coach, you were Clive Barker, you were the epitome of a South African coach. Did you ever get approaches from Chiefs or Pirates to lead their respective teams?
I think the only time was when Kaza would have spoken to me about the national job. I was locked over, he worked with me at Puma and had moved on to Joburg. And so I think it thought at that stage that Kaza might be interested, but I know that, knew that Mark was away from Durban and me going up there would have made it much harder for business-wise. So that's the reason I didn't get an offer, I think, because I never pushed it. People would have thought, would I like to have the opportunity? Gosh, I would have loved to serve the top side in cars I had in 1992. I think we walked backwards in coach that team. But I think the best team I've ever had at a club level was by far Bushbucks.
Yes, the 85 winning team.
Professor Ngobani, Calvin Peterson, Mark Mangetta, Dave Watterson, all international players and would have played for the final if they had been a bit younger. Absolutely terrific all round, and they were able to score the quality of goals that they did. Calvin Peterson, no field up front. Professor, I could watch him all day and he would take the balls out and juggle here and do this and do that. And I remember when we ever went to play the sides down in Cape Town.
Yeah.
Professor would say to me, why are you looking so worried, coach? He said, you know, this is my territory. And he would go on there and he would dictate the whole thing, and it was absolutely marvelous. And I might have the correction here, but I think that they won the league without losing a match. And then they lost a couple of rounds at the end, but they had won the league well in advance before it had ended. I think the fact is that along the Pirates, it would have been a good challenge. And I think everybody to work for was Kaza Matondi. You only got to see the patience he showed to his team. He's a great leader and also a good, very good footballer. Very elegant. And of course, Ryan Duke, as he was known, was a terrific person. And remember when we had that problem up in Congo?
Yes.
On the Saturday afternoon, how he walked through there and just read the rifle that was pointing in that direction. When we had all that problems. And of course, he was trying to get there, how strong he was.
Sure.
And they never did. And maybe it would have been too easy to win something. I don't know. I don't know. But they had magnificent teams. But the best team that I ever handled, no doubt about it, was Bushback.
The day onwards, I was covering soccer for the Daily News in Durban, and I was also lucky in that Bushbucks were the champions that year. Clive Barker was the coach. It was a magnificent team. Lungisi Ngubani, Daniel Ramaruzzi,
yes.
Mark Tovey, Mike Mangena was my favorite player. He was magnificent. Calvin Peterson, Ian Chester, Dave Watterson was the goalkeeper, Raul Gonzalez.
Come on.
And as they got better and better through the year, so I traveled with them to away games to cover it for the paper. And my own profile obviously increased, and I got a job at the Star. So I'm very grateful to Clive Barker and to Bushbucks and to that whole group of players who welcomed me as a young 21, 22-year-old,
wow.
And allowed me to insider access and allowed me to cover them as they won the championship.
That's the voice of Mark Gleeson.
whenever Bafana Bafana would play on the national broadcast in the 90s, there were always two things I could expect. The blue score bug in the top left corner. At the time, no other team got that. And the commentary of Mark Gleeson. I grew up loving his voice and commentary style, and secretly always wondered where his journey with the beautiful game began.
I was lucky in that I was kind of from a football family. My father played. He came from Pretoria. We grew up in Pretoria as young kids. We went to football. We were big Arcadia Shepherds fans. In those days, let's say I was sort of 8, 9, 10 years old. I played in the junior team there. I went to every second Friday night or Saturday night when Arcadia were playing at home. My parents took us to watch. So we were, you know, we were proper traveling, proper supporters. With the rosettes on, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, I don't remember much about the football, but I loved the crowd.
The nights out.
Yeah, the night out and just the atmosphere and the swearing. I loved the swearing and the humor, you know. And in those days, of course, it was apartheid. This was in the mid-70s. I mean, my first season I can really remember was 1974 in the old white-only National Football League. Arcadia won the treble. They were a magnificent team. Roy Matthews was my big hero. He later became, of course, a very successful coach with Jomo Cosmos.
Yes.
The crowds were segregated then, and you'd have like you'd have 3/4 of the crowd of the stadium would be reserved for whites, and then there'd be sort of like a black section which was always packed, and it was always where the best humor was. You know, And we would sit often very close. My father loved the humor, and we'd sit very close to the fence, and we'd listen to the banter, as it were. Absolutely loved it, and I was besotted right from the beginning. And of course, my team won everything in those early days, and then so it grew from there. I mean, I think you've got to have those kind of influences in your life, and I'm very grateful that my parents did that.
Mark, where are the player, where, in terms of diversity in South Africa? Obviously, South Africa is probably one of the most participated sports by the populace. But in terms of demographics and spread, where are the Indian players? Where are the white guys who are playing, who have obvious talents playing 5-a-side, and we see them week in, week out when you go to Tuesday or Wednesday leagues? Where are those guys in terms of coming through, playing actual football? Or is it a case of, for them, it's a thing of, this is just a midweek thing. I'm not really keen. Where are those players?
No, I think it's a racism thing, to be honest with you. It's the structures of what used to be sort of white amateur football, Indian amateur football, have broken down because of integration. There is a reluctance on the part of white people to get in their car now and to go on a Saturday afternoon to Khayelitsha or Soweto or wherever it might be and play amateur football. It's a function of integration. It's the same as what happened with white people and watching football. You know, there were healthy crowds in the 1970s. Yes. When I was a young boy, of white people who loved their football and went to watch. And then when the race barriers broke down and the white league, the NFL, joined the black league, the white league actually folded into the black league. Great irony in those days of apartheid. The crowds just disappeared, and it's a racism thing. You know, people didn't want to go and sit with fellow South Africans in the stand. I think we've got to be candid about it, you know. And I think that's the same as what's happened with amateur footballers. People don't want to let little Johnny go and play football potentially in a township on the weekend. And I think it's wrong, you know. It's sad. It's very, very sad that's the approach of the minority communities in this country that don't want to integrate themselves better with the majority, if I can put it that plainly. I think and we will only start, we see less and less young white boys and Indian boys and coming through the ranks because they don't play as much football as they did before.
Sure.
and that is to the detriment of the our national team eventually, because you know, each group I think does bring its own little positives to the party. But at the end of the day, you can't force the horse to water. You can put the water out there for them to drink, but it doesn't mean they're going to drink it. And I think it's a real sadness that we still don't have the right attitude towards participation and integration.
Now, when I think of voices that raised us in this last year where we've lost a powerful voice like Kaunda and Ndunja, and I think about the voices that raised us, that raised me in particular, I think of Ubab Zama Masondo, I think of you, and I think of Martin Tyler. Martin Tyler, Premier, because of obviously his work with the Premier League, but also because he was the voice, he's been the voice of FIFA pretty much for most of its popular run. And when I think of these voices that pretty much raised me in terms of growing my love for football, my question is, who influenced you in terms of your as you've grown in your commentating style and how you tell the message or you tell the viewer?
Yeah, I think Martin Tyler was always one to listen to. I try not to listen to too many guys too often, if you know what I mean, because you do tend to almost subconsciously copy. And so you try and mix it up. I mean, today there's so many different commentators out there and many guys have got their own way of doing it. But I like Trevor Quirk very much as a youngster. I think I copied a lot of him subconsciously. Martin Tyler, certainly. I'd say those were the two.
Yeah.
I was very conscious right from the beginning that television was different to radio, and it was, you know, much more about identification and information as opposed to description, which is what radio is. You've got to paint the picture for the listener who can't see. And a lot of TV commentating in South Africa, even to this day, still is almost painting a picture that the viewer can see, because a lot of the guys come from a radio background. Yeah. So I was always very conscious that you mustn't do that. You know, it's obvious that the ball is moving from left to right. The guy can see it, or the ball is just crossed the halfway line. The guy can, the viewer can see that, but who is delivering it? And then, you know, just offering some little tidbits of information here and there without overwhelming. It's not necessarily the best style. But it's one that I think Martin Tyler was very good at, and that I enjoy listening to. So that's the one I sort of look to employ. Rather say less than more, but also not too little.
Yes.
Because you've got to keep some interest in the game.
So the best goal I've ever seen, there's got to be two. First, Cristiano Ronaldo's free kick against Portsmouth in 2008 that he took from about 30 yards away. It's one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And then there's Wayne Rooney's goal that won us the match against Manchester City. It was a bicycle kick and the match ended 2-1. It happened late in the game, I think 70-something minute. Also, just goosebumps every time I replay it or I think about it.
As an Arsenal fan, it's painful to say this, but Michael Essien's shot from outside the box against Arsenal, where he hit it with the outside of his foot and bent it from outside the post to in, that was an absolute scream, and I couldn't believe what I'd seen when that ball went in.
Sticks to mind is the UEFA Champions League 2001, Real Madrid versus Bayer Leverkusen. A cross came in from the left from Roberto Carlos. As he crossed the ball, Zidane volleyed the ball in with his left foot, which was his weaker foot. For me, just that quick thinking, I've played that video over and over again. He had 3 seconds actually to think how he's gonna shoot that ball and how he executed it. I think that was great.
I'm from Limpopo, so the answer is kinda obvious. It has to be Oscar Rini's extra time equalizing bicycle kick goal against Pirates. Sure, that was a mouthful. He was nominated for a FIFA Puskas Award and Ronaldo said that he deserved it.
So coming from a writing background, you were also the the editor of Kickoff magazine sometime in the past, from a bird's eye view of football, as you are there, obviously, you're seeing it pretty much. How has the game changed for you?
It's changed massively to the positive. I mean, I think it's so much nicer now. It's more exciting. It's much more athletic. It's much more of a contest between top quality athletes. I mean, you know, you hear a lot of guys saying, well, in my day, or, you know, it's, football is not like it used to be. I think that's all a load of rubbish, you know. Football, in, if you think about it just logically, football in the 70s and the 80s was semi-professional. A lot of guys had jobs. A lot of guys, certainly, they did not train the way they do now. They train three nights a week or four nights a week. You ask even a generation that's just passed now, you know, people like, let's say, Neil Tovey, Mark Tovey, they'll tell you when they started playing professionally at Durban City, they only trained three nights a week. Now, how is it physically possible that they could be, that kind of player can be anything like the athlete that we see today?
Sure.
Today's game might not have as much opportunity, might not have as many goals. I think it has as much flair as it had in the past. It might not have as much showmanship because it's a lot more professional, but it certainly has as much flair, if not more, because you need skills and flair more today. Because it's so difficult to play, because you're playing against, you know, someone who's well prepared, who's athletic, who's fit. It's not like it was in the past at all. So people who sort of hark back to the old days and paint this picture that we're not watching football today that is anything like the quality of the past, I think they're talking rubbish, you know.
Yeah.
Football is better every single year. I'm a great believer in these are the days, not those are the days.
Okay. Now, what I wanted to ask then is there ever been a game that you actually felt like, I wish I wasn't behind the mic and I actually wish I was in the stands looking at this game and not having to relay a message about it?
I get a little bit nervous when South Africa play, but and I do like to see South African sides do well when they play in African competition. I mean, one of the nicest games I ever watched was in my own lounge. When I think Pirates played Esperance, 2013, I think I'm right in saying, semi-final of the Champions League. They drew 1-1. They drew 0-0 at home.
Yeah.
And they drew 1-1 away to qualify for the final, where they lost to Al Ahly. I think Roy Mahmutsa scored the equalizer. But it was one of those games where, one of the few games where I sort of cheered a team, but ordinarily I would never cheer Orlando Pirates, nor would I cheer Kaizer Chiefs, nor would I cheer Mamelodi Sundowns. But I, you know, when they played Zamalek, I mean, it's impossible not to want them to win. But I very rarely feel the need to support. And if I watch a football match, I sit down, not taking a side. I sit down with a cold eye and I look at the formation and what's the coach trying to do here? And, you know, who's playing well? This guy's not getting in the game, that kind of stuff, as opposed to, come on, guys, we need to win. You know, that's over the years, I've kind of evolved away from being a supporter. And it's you get accused a lot, particularly on social media, you know, when you say something, oh, that guy's a Sundowns fan, or oh, that Gleeson, he only loves Orlando Pirates, you know, he hates Kaizer Chiefs. And then in the same day, someone else will tweet, oh, you can hear every time Chiefs go on the attack, the excitement in Gleeson's voice. And to all of that, I mean, it's all perception of the listener's ear. But I genuinely have no passion for any PSL club whatsoever. My team died long time ago, Arcadia Shepherds.
Why I love football? This one I had to dig deep. But football has been a way of life. It has been more than just a game. I had something to look forward to, like to do extraordinary moves, to do a spectacular save, and the sense of accomplishment after such moves, and everyone would look at you just like you've performed a magic trick.
Football messes with our heads and knows how to play with our heartstrings. I mean, where else could you hear a commentator saying that someone has an intelligent right foot?
It is the best reality show because it's unscripted. You can never really tell what will happen until the final whistle is blown.
I love football because some of my best childhood memories are centered or focused around football. I used to watch a lot of football with my father growing up. He was a huge Moroka Swallows supporter. So you can imagine how happy he is now that they're back in the Premiership. But yeah, so just great memories bonding with my dad. They've always involved football. And honestly speaking, very few things make me as happy as football does.
You've seen a lot of players come and go. Are there any players that you saw when you saw them for that first time and you thought to yourself, my goodness, this guy is going to be special, either local or international?
I think that a lot of these guys evolve. I remember Karma Bilyat coming on at the as a substitute for the very first time for Ajax. And I remember making a mistake because I didn't know who he was and I hadn't done my homework. And Bilyat is an Ivorian name. Very common Ivorian name. And I said, Ajax, a youngster from the Ivory Coast, Karma Bilyat. And of course, I was completely wrong. He came from Zimbabwe. It was a very bad mistake. And I remember that. And I remember him coming on and thinking, ooh, this guy is something. I remember Dane Clate coming on for his first appearance as a substitute. I was the commentator there as well. Mm. But you don't really have a sense at that stage that they are going to become special players. I mean, we got very excited about a player like Siwatla, for example, when he was 15 years old or 16 years old, and he scored for Ajax against Dynamos, the youngest ever player in a South African professional match, as well as the youngest ever goal scorer. Gordon Ingerson, I think, was the coach who gave him his first chance. And there you think, okay, wow, this guy, you know, he's 15. I mean, can you imagine what he's going to be like at the age of 20?
Yeah.
But then things just didn't turn out for him, you know? So to be honest with you, there's never really been like a wow moment. I think it's a lot of it's an evolutionary process. I mean, I remember going to watch, not for television, but just going to watch pre-season a couple of years ago. Wits had a tournament where they would invite three other clubs. They do it behind closed doors. Hmm. And they play like each other 45 minutes and they sort of rotate and it gives coaches a chance to use basically everybody. And Aces had Temba Zwane there. He was Sundown's property, but he wasn't really in the team. He'd been loaned out somewhere else. And then Aces were going to have a look at him. And because they didn't play him in the first 30-minute scrimmage, Olzwane got a long lip about it and left the stadium, and they all went rushing after him to sort of bring him back and say, hey, where are you going? You know, we're going to play you. Don't worry. You know, you'll get a chance. And I remember him on that day not being anything special, and you're thinking, well, you probably won't keep him, you know. First of all, after his petulant walk-off, followed by a fairly mediocre performance, you know, this guy's not really going to get a contract at Aces, and he's not really going to amount to much. Now you take forward the clock. I mean, he did get a contract with Aces. He had a great season. Sundowns saw the mistake of their ways, brought him back into the team, and I think he was the best player last season. I think the award for the best footballer for this recent season that's just been completed should be given to Temba Zwane. So, you know, what a difference it is from watching him at the Wits Stadium probably, can't remember now, let's say 6 or 7 years ago, or maybe even 5 years ago, how things have changed for him. So, there's very rarely those kind of lightning moments in player recognition. I think a lot of it's very evolutionary.
Mm. Okay. Lastly, is there a game that springs out to you which is hands down your favorite game to have commentated?
The biggest game I ever did was the opening game of the World Cup in 98 when South Africa lost to France in Marseille. Oh. And I still have a certificate here on the wall in my office that says you participated in the biggest television event of SABC history. That game had the biggest audience. It broke the record, which was set when Mandela left Victor Verster prison in Paro. You know, the live coverage
the walkout
of him walking out, and people had never seen him. Remember, people were waiting, had only got these old
black and white images of this youthful man, you know, with that big side parting.
Yes.
No one had seen him. And so can you imagine how many viewers they had that day watching just for a first glimpse of Mandela? So that first World Cup game broke the record. And I think I'm right in saying it's still one of, I mean, I presume it's been beaten maybe by the first game of 2010 when Shabo scored that goal.
Yes.
I would presume that the record's been beaten, but I have a certificate here that says I participated in that record-breaking broadcast. I remember very little about the broadcast. I just remember being very conscious of the fact that, you know, we were probably going to speak to the largest audience in South African television history, and being a little bit nervous about that. But the game was very, very disappointing, as you will remember.
Painfully so.
France.
Painfully
so. With two own goals. But yeah, those just to be at, those were massively historic moments of South African football, and to be there and to have been the voice on television is also a special privilege.
One of the takeaways from my conversation with Mark is how he, as a commentator, is always being accused of being biased. Personally, I think it's unrealistic for the public to think that people in sport shouldn't have a favorite team. Like saying a chef isn't entitled to having a favorite dish. You're not going to accuse that chef of doing a substandard job of cooking your meal just because her favorite dish is something else. But I digress. Former Italy coach Arrigo Sacchi once said, "Football is the most important of the least important things in life." Yes, it is just a game at the end of the day. But what a beautiful game it is. Thank you for listening to Falling in Sport. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the episode and suggestions on future episodes. Also, if you're a fan of another sport and would like your voice featured in the memories and thoughts for upcoming episodes, you can send us an email at fallinginsport@gmail.com. To make sure you don't miss out on future episodes, subscribe to and rate Falling in Sport on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Iono FM, or wherever you listen. Oh, and give us a follow on the socials too. Talk to you soon.